May it please the court. This appeal is before the court on transfer from the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals affirmed the trial court's denial of appellant's Rule 7406B motion that was filed after an underlying judgment was entered. And I want to address, first of all, where we believe that the Court of Appeals erred in its decision. And to set that up, just briefly, some of the procedural facts before the court. The underlying judgment was September 11, 2006. That was the trial in which the Canes proceeded without Ms. Porter or her counsel present. Following that trial, there was a motion to set aside, timely filed within 30 days after the trial. It was actually amended once, which was also within 30 days, but the two together I will just refer to as the motion to set aside.
And nothing in that motion raised the bankruptcy?
Nothing in that motion raised the issue of the bankruptcy, and that's a very important point, I believe.
Is there a stay from the bankruptcy court still in operation? Can we actually proceed given the supremacy of the federal courts?
Well, it's an interesting question, Your Honor.
That original stay is gone because the case, he was discharged, right?
There was a discharge of my client. That case is gone,
but there's a new stay.
There was a new bankruptcy filed last week on behalf of my client, and I brought that matter to the court's attention yesterday. It's my understanding from speaking with Respondent's Counsel that an emergency motion to lift that stay for purposes of this oral argument was filed.
I was just going to ask, why are we here?
And granted.
Oh, granted. Okay. Has that been filed with the court?
Your Honor, that's correct. If I may interrupt, that's correct. I have a printout of electronic entry of the order for the purpose of this argument.
I wasn't copied on the emergency motion that was filed in the bankruptcy court yesterday or received a copy of the order, and I just found out last night from the
But he has a separate bankruptcy counsel who did know about it.
Yes. Okay. Yes. Sherry Porter is my client.
Okay.
So that we had the underlying judgment and a motion to set aside that was denied. That is really the first final judgment that we have in this case. We then have a motion for reconsideration, and there's been a lot of confusion about the motion for reconsideration, motion to reconsider. It was filed by Ms. Porter's underlying circuit court counsel after the 30-day period for a timely post-trial motion. And that motion to reconsider was ultimately denied by Judge Clark on March 13, 2007. The key here is that Judge Clark's denial of that motion to reconsider, and what do we want to call the motion to reconsider? The Court of Appeals suggested it could be considered an independent action in equity in and of itself. Or I guess alternatively, it could be considered an untimely post-trial motion. Those are probably the two options. Judge Clark denied that motion to reconsider in an order dated March 13, 2007. That order itself was not a final judgment. It is simply denominated an order. And it's on page 111 of volume 1 of the legal file. It is an order denying the motion to reconsider.
But your point is you don't appeal motions to reconsider rulings. You appeal the underlying judgment. So the denial of the motion to set aside is what's up on appeal, not the denial of the motion to reconsider.
Well, no, Your Honor. Okay. It's kind of going through the facts a little bit more. So we have the underlying judgment, the motion set aside. It was not timely appealed.
Okay.
There was the motion to reconsider, which was denied by order, but not by final judgment. Then we have the motion under Rule 7406 that was later filed to set aside the judgment as void. What the Court of Appeals found was this later motion to declare the underlying judgment void was barred by issue preclusion because it had been raised in the motion to reconsider. Yet that motion to reconsider was never a final judgment. So there was nothing to properly appeal. Yes, a notice of appeal was filed, and it was dismissed. But I submit that the Court of Appeals would have dismissed that appeal anyway because the order from which it was appealed was not final. So then we have these two motions after the underlying judgment. We have these two motions that raise the issue of the bankruptcy stay. And I submit that that's where we are before this court, that the Court of Appeals did not recognize. The Court of Appeals found that the 7406 motion was barred by issue preclusion, and we submit that as error. And what the Court of Appeals said was, if the issue had been properly preserved, we might well conclude that Porter's bankruptcy filing prevented the circuit court from proceeding in this personal injury action, and that the resulting judgment entered by the circuit court is void. And I submit that's where we are before this honorable court.
Well, why wouldn't, I mean, the bankruptcy judge, who's got jurisdiction over the bankruptcy, entered an order that said that they never would have stayed these proceedings. If you, even if you'd have brought it to their attention, they wouldn't have stayed the proceedings.
Well, and that's a very important.
They already were stayed, but he would have set it aside. I mean, they're automatically stayed.
Are you referring to the bankruptcy court order from January of this
well,
year?
Well, because there was no effect on the person's personal assets, then there's an order from the bankruptcy court indicating that it wouldn't have, that there would have been no stay in effect had it been.
Well,
and they weren't listed, so there was a discharge order without their having been listed. So they weren't included in the original discharge order.
The Canes were. The Canes were identified as creditors in the bankruptcy and were listed
but
as creditors.
This claim was discharged.
But the insurance company wasn't.
They were creditors of the insurance company, in fact.
Well, that gets to the effect of the stipulation to lift the stay, mm-hmm. which it was we've submitted to the court in our latest supplement to the legal file, and that's in the fourth supplemental legal file.
But it was never filed with the court, so what effect does it have?
Exactly. That there was a stipulation that was signed by my client's bankruptcy counsel after meeting with respondent's counsel, agreeing to lift the stay to the extent or the recovery against debtor shall not exceed the limits of any applicable insurance coverage. But it was never filed with the bankruptcy court. And these proposed stipulations signed by counsel don't have effect in and of themselves. They have to be presented to the bankruptcy court and acted upon.
It's a motion to lift stay, not a stipulation to lift stay.
Essentially, right. Yes, Your Honor.
So the court has to act.
And we submit that under either a void or a voidable standard, the respondents proceeding to trial in the underlying case, when they know there's a bankruptcy, when they know there's a stay, when they've received the agreement of bankruptcy counsel to lift it for a limited purpose, but they don't act on it, that's inequitable. And that the appellant here should be entitled to rely upon the rule of law, that those types of stipulations have to be presented to the bankruptcy court and acted upon before a trial can take place against her in the circuit court.
Tell us what the rulings of the bankruptcy court have been concerning this matter.
Okay.
I mean, the ones after the judgment.
After the only time we've been in the bankruptcy court on this matter, after the Court of Appeals decision from last September, in which the Court of Appeals had a footnote suggested that maybe the federal court was the proper entity, and before we knew that this court was going to accept transfer, we filed a motion to reopen the bankruptcy case, because it had already been discharged and closed. We filed a motion to reopen it in order to file a motion to set aside the circuit court judgment as void. That was the purpose of attempting to reopen the bankruptcy case for that limited purpose. We got to the bankruptcy proceeding, and in fact, I appeared before the bankruptcy court to argue the motion to declare that circuit court judgment void. And instead of arguing that day, there was a motion to continue filed on behalf of the respondents. So we had no hearing that day. Then ultimately, The bankruptcy judge decided that he was not going to reopen the bankruptcy case. He entered an order vacating the prior order to open the case. Based on the statement of counsel for the Canes that they weren't going to try to seek any recovery from Ms. Porter personally. And based on that, the bankruptcy judge decided that there was no reason to reopen the bankruptcy case because there was no possibility of anything adverse.
Well, that debt had already been discharged against her personally anyway, right? So you
that's what the judge...
But the judgment is against her personally, and there's an outstanding larger judgment, which counsel just says they won't try to enforce.
Right, right. Okay. So after the bankruptcy judge decided not to reopen the bankruptcy case, then we are now here before this court asking the court to decide on the merits now, which the bankruptcy court did not do, this issue of whether or not the underlying circuit court judgment should be set aside. And under either a void or voidable standard, or if you look at the 7406 motion as an independent action in equity, if you look at the equities of the situation, we submit proceeding to trial against somebody when you know there's a bankruptcy stay, and then getting a judgment far in excess of what they could have ever received, it's not equitable. And
but didn't
not
the bankruptcy court court here didn't the bankruptcy court here say there was no violation of the automatic stay?
Yes, unfortunately, in an amended order vacating the reopening of the bankruptcy case, the court made a statement to that effect, and we submit that statement has no preclusion effect whatsoever before this court, because the issue was never before the court on the merits for two reasons. We filed an expansive motion to have the court look at this issue as to whether or not the circuit court judgment should be set aside. And the court never addressed that on the merits.
Did you appeal this order or this decision?
We did not appeal the decision because having the bankruptcy court not reopen its case was a decision we were fine with. Having now being before this court.
You weren't harmed by the results.
We're not harmed by the fact that the bankruptcy case was not reopened because we have that issue before this court. So that's not a ruling that was adverse to.
If I understand what the bankruptcy court said was not that proceeding against Ms. Porter wouldn't have violated the stay, but that since opposing counsel said they would only try to execute the judgment against the insurance company, therefore it didn't involve Ms. Porter, therefore something against another party wouldn't violate the stay of actions against Ms. Porter.
You're correct, Your Honor. And in fact, the bankruptcy court found that because of the representation of counsel that they were not going to proceed against her personally, the court found that there was no basis under the bankruptcy rule to reopen her case. So basically,
the bankruptcy judge also said that it wouldn't have violated the automatic stay.
The court made a statement, unfortunately, that was not on the merits. We never had an opportunity to argue that.
But that's what my question was. Wasn't the reason he said that was because it was only against the insurance company and the stay was actions against her. So isn't that why he said, or am I misinterpreting his order?
I think that would be a very proper interpretation of what the court's amended order states. And in that regard, I would urge the court, if the court wants to look at this issue further, to compare the court's initial order vacating the reopening and that amended order. And you will see that the court really did not have before it the issue that we have here of setting aside the circuit.
Now, when the bankruptcy court stays the proceeding, it's void ab initio. So can they resuscitate something that's void ab initio by I guess they can.
That is a confusing issue, even in the federal court system. Even court cases that find that a proceeding is void ab initio have, on occasion, found ways to retroactively rescind that under certain circumstances if a proper motion to do that is filed by the person who wants to set aside the stay.
Any further questions? Thank you. Mr. Thompson.
May you please report.
The
the only basis upon which this judgment can be held invalid is that the automatic stay has been violated. And I think Mr. Weiss has a fundamental misunderstanding of what the bankruptcy stay actually does. The bankruptcy stay protects the debtor, and it protects the debtor's property. It does not protect the debtor's insurance company.
But your judgment was against the debtor, not against the insurer, and for a huge amount. Not just the amount that they agreed to in the stipulation, which was the amount of the insurance coverage. So I'm not clear how...
Well, first of all, Your Honor, there's nothing in the record as to what the insurance amount is. There's absolutely nowhere in the record besides a reference in this brief. There's nothing in the legal file about that amount.
But there's... And this may reflect my lack of understanding of all the issues in bankruptcy, so you could advise me on it. But I know you're saying that now, and I'm sure correctly, that you're only going to try to execute it against the insurance company, but there's an underlying judgment against Ms. Porter. That's who the judgment is against. Why doesn't that violate the bankrupt? That's the automatic stay. You don't have to seek a stay. It's an automatic stay. I don't see how, until such time as you're bound somehow later on to only recover against the insurance company, you're violating the stay when you're proceeding.
Well, Your Honor, there were technical violations. I think if you read Judge Venter's opinion, and I think the case of, in the case of either, I think in Henry Williams or Henry Lett, he talks about this being a former bankruptcy trustee, stay violations happen all the time. It's whether they actually affect these two things, the debtor personally or the estate of the debtor, the property. It's whether there's actually a true violation of the stay.
Well, tell me, and the reason I ask is a notice issue, basically, that I'm concerned about, and perhaps you can address for me, which is that there's an automatic stay until it's lifted.
Right.
So when notice of this case came about, that your clients were listed as creditors in the bankruptcy action, and counsel talked, and they reached a stipulation about lifting the stay up to the amount of the insurance coverage. But a stipulation has no effect. As I said in a question earlier, you have to file a motion to lift stay. It's not automatic. It's up to the court to decide. Why didn't counsel in the underlying action here have a right to assume that you could not? Counsel had a right to assume you could not proceed unless and until the motion to lift stay was filed and granted. And the concern here is that counsel was not present when this case was tried. And why counsel did not get notice because of some issue and was not aware of this trial date at the time and therefore was not present there, unbeknownst to the court who thought that counsel had notice. That's not surprising since normally counsel would have an obligation to keep track of what's going on in a case and be aware when they're set. But if counsel believed that until the bankruptcy court issued an order, there would be this case could not proceed because it was still stayed, I'm not clear where counsel's obligation to keep track of what's going on was violated.
Well, they have also an obligation to raise the issue. They had
I'm looking at the underlying issue first. Don't we have a notice and fairness problem where this case proceeded without their knowledge, and their lack of knowledge was because they never received notice that the stay had been lifted?
Well,
they timely appealed it, wouldn't they have won?
Well, Your Honor, they had notice of the same the entire time. They had notice when they engaged in discovery. Any requirements of notice they waived because they participated. They filed an answer. After summons of this case, they filed an answer. They participated in discovery. And the debtor and its insurance carrier were notified of the trial date. That's in the record. Judge Gray's order continued the case and reset for trial was sent to Ms. Porter and their insurance carrier. So obviously they
had not to counsel, and you knew they were represented by counsel.
And then I think also, Your Honor, I sent one of the exhibits. It's not part of the record. But it's in a transcript where I sent notice to the lawyer that the matter was set for trial. I sent him another copy of the order.
Was the insurance company defending at that point?
Yes.
They were?
Yeah, it's insurance carrier.
Okay. So the lawyer for this person was actually the insurance company's lawyer?
Yes.
But they said
that did not show up for the trial?
Right.
But they said they did not get the notice even though they were listed as on their record. No notice was sent to them because the court failed to note that, and there's nothing showing notice was sent to them.
The timing was this.
I'm not saying anybody's at fault. I'm just saying the fact is that...
The entry appearance came shortly before the judge actually entered the order, and it hadn't hit the file yet.
I understand, but nobody was trying to hide it. But the fact is they didn't get the notice, even though they were counsel on record.
I remedied that by sending a copy of that order to Ms. Porter's lawyer at the time. I'm sorry, Dr. Simmons.
That's okay. Yes.
Was there a proof of service did you send a proof of service on that?
I sent it with a cover letter. And I mentioned it in the hearing of the... at the trial of this case, I submitted a copy of that letter to the court to show that they did have notice of it.
Why aren't these confused procedural issues and notice issues good cause to set aside the judgment and let them have a trial at which they can appear?
Well, those issues are because that judgment is final. We're only here today because the Rule 7406B motion that the judgment is void. And to be void, there has to be totally void and null, not capable of...
Going back to the trial, when the insurance company lawyer did not appear, did you or the judge or the trial counsel or the judge make any attempt to contact him to come to the trial?
No, Your Honor.
And he was in trial across the hall, it turns out, at the time.
Your Honor, to my knowledge, no. I mean, that was an allegation made in the
thing. And you can...
But...
You mean you have no knowledge, or you deny it? You say that's false.
She was not... The lawyer that was on this case was not in trial across the hall. I know that for a fact, because Mr. Smith from St. Louis was in trial. It was the attorney of record. Ms. Chappell, I've never met before, never had any correspondence with her before.
So it wasn't Sprung versus Neguir, where the trial court may not have known that there was... defense counsel. There was an entry of appearance by the defense counsel, and no one called the defense counsel about the case.
No.
But irrespective of all that, that order is final, right? That order is not before the court.
That's not.
They didn't appeal that order.
No.
We're on something totally separate. Even if all that's true, we're on their second motion here today, right?
We're on the second motion as to whether this judgment is void as a matter of law. And that issue has already been decided by the bankruptcy court. The bankruptcy court took this thing. It was a ruling on the merits.
Well, bankruptcy court doesn't get to decide if the state judgment's void. But
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
Well, I mean, the bankruptcy court has a ruling, final, non-appealable, that there was no violation of the automatic stay. Without that violation of the automatic stay,
but the reason, what's the reason for that? Because you said, look at the stay has to do with claims against the debtor, and we're not making a claim against the debtor. We're only going to proceed against the insurer. Was that the basis? That's the only basis there could be.
True, Your Honor, but that's the only basis we ever had. That's the same thing.
But the judgment's against the debtor. I don't understand.
Well,
and for a lot more than the insurance.
In Missouri, we cannot proceed against the insurance company directly. We don't have direct cause of action. We can only go against the debtor. Per se, we can only go against them. So they have to be a named party. But their contractual obligation to protect the insured, to protect the debtor, and pay any judgments against her, that's their obligation. That's what we have to go. And the only thing we're asking in this case is the same thing would have if the actual order lifting the stay would have been entered at the same time. And that's what the bankruptcy court
said. Isn't the action any action against the insurance company derivative from the... Since you can't bring in a direct action against the insurance company, doesn't the inference occur that the actions against the defendant and the claim against the insurance company is derivative against the action against the defendant?
True.
Adeline, but your judgment is for $200,000 or plus.
Right.
The insurance coverage is $50,000. So I don't see how this does not affect the credit and everything else of the debtor. It's not just against the insurer. It's far more.
Well, how the judgment came is the fault of the insurance carrier. I mean, the bankruptcy state should not protect the insurance carrier from their negligence and their failure to protect their insured under its contractual obligation on the insurance contract. And that's essentially what this case is about, is protecting the insurance carrier and not the debtor.
Now, I realize that the court here said there was not a violation of the automatic stay, but aren't there certain situations in the law where retroactive validations of acts violating the stay?
That's true, Your Honor. I mean, that, Mr. Weiss alluded to that. There is a conflict in not only in the Western District of Missouri Bankruptcy Court, but throughout the nation about whether something in violation of stay is void ab initio or void, or voidable. Judge Venters said, you know, as opined in these cases, that has to be a total nullity. And if since cases, the bankruptcy court has the power to go back and annul, amend, or do anything with the stay it wishes to do, that in effect goes back to retroactively okays stay, you know, violations of the stay. And that's essentially what Judge Fetterman did in this case. His order is really a retroactive lifting of the stay to proceed on his judgment against the insurance carrier, which he has the power and authority to do. And that's what happened in this case. Whether you call it void or voidable, Judge Fetterman's order of January essentially retroactively modified the stay that we can proceed on this judgment against Ms. Porter's insurance carrier.
Was that appealed?
That was not appealed.
Was there anything appealable there? I mean, he did not reopen it, right?
Well, he ordered it. The reason he appealed is because he basically retroactively lifted the stay, modified the stay, and finding that there was no stay violation. With no stay violation, there was no purpose. With that finding, with that order, there's no reason to reopen his stay, since we weren't going against Ms. Porter personal assets.
How can his judgment not, well, never mind, go ahead. If it's not reopened, then what is the order in? What is appealable? What, he had to reopen it at least for the purposes of that order.
Well, appealable. The order denied it. If they also, you know, they had an order, a motion to file us, hold us in contempt for violating the stay, to have the judgment held void. And Judge Fetterman, by taking that judge, modifying the stay by saying there was no stay violation, that they were allowed to go against the insurance company, that the judgment is valid, he in effect modified the stay retroactively for we can proceed against the insurance carrier and not against Ms. Porter personally. That's the same thing would happen if
the insurance carrier have standing to file an appeal of the bankruptcy judge's order.
They had the absolute standing to do that. They had a standing to file a motion to amend that judgment, and they also had the standing to appeal that. Yet they chose not to. And now that judgment can spawn an order, and they're bound.
How could they appeal it? They're not in the bankruptcy action. They're not a party.
Yes, they are.
Bankrupt
is. Ms. Porter's a party in it, and she had, and Mr. Weiss represented her at this hearing in front of Judge Fetterman. They had a right to file an appeal on that.
Ms. Porter or the insurance company?
Well, Ms. Porter's attorneys, who are hired by the insurance company, who represent her in the bank,
his point, he said he wasn't actually harmed by that order because it affirmed that you can't go against her, and therefore there really wasn't anything for her to appeal.
But there was thing because the order said that they go against Mrs. Porter's insurance company mm-hmm. and that the stay wasn't violated. These were rulings fairly made on the issues that were crucial to this whole case that binds everyone about the stay violation. And so since that they were harmed by that, they should appeal that. And so now we have a final judgment that they're collaterally stopped from asserting again before this court. They don't get that many bites of the apple. They could have raised this issue before the judgment even entered, but they never did. That was bite number two. They could have raised it in a motion to set aside a judgment. That was bite number two. But they held the other apple behind their back on the bankruptcy, and they took that apple out after the Western District Court Appeals ruled and said, hey, we want to take this apple over to bankruptcy court and take a bite out of it. And then it turned out it was mealy. They didn't like it, so they came back to the other apple.
This is unlike the other cases the Court of Appeals cited. They had no benefit from not appearing and holding the bankruptcy apple behind their back. This is not where they defended on the merits and lost and then tried to pull it up. They didn't get noticed because the bankruptcy stay hadn't been lifted. I mean, I know we're not back there, but that very much affects whether retroactively lifting the stay is fair.
Well, those are jurisdictional. I mean, I think that's a jurisdictional thing that matter. If they're attacking the jurisdiction of the trial court on this violation of automatic stay, they have a duty to raise it. And if they can't, they waive it. In all of the bankruptcy courses I've
studied. Unless it's void. If it's void, it's void whether it's raised or not.
But since the bankruptcy court can go back and retroactively do it, by its very definition, it's not void.
Of course, that's unsettled law, isn't it?
Well, even under the void ab initio, it can still go back and be retroactively lifted, and then by that very definition, makes it not void.
Sounds like we're dancing on the head of a pin here.
I understand it. I mean, that's what...
Why isn't there a serious notice issue that we can address in state court for that, where you could give someone no notice of it and then after the fact validate it? Why would we be bound by that? Why can't we look at whether or not... why don't we decide whether or not our own judgments are void, whatever the bankruptcy court may say about its stay?
I agree that this court and the state court had jurisdiction to make this matter. I suggest that maybe the bankruptcy court, with his experience of bankruptcy law and violations of the state, may be a better forum.
For deciding whether it's a stay violation, but not right. For deciding if our own judgments are void or voidable.
Well, true, Your Honor, but without a stay violation, it can't be void. It has to be a state violation in order to be void. And if there's no state violation, by its very definition, it can't be void.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Very briefly on this waiver issue, I would cite to the court a case that's in our brief, Owsley, O-U-S-L-E-Y, versus Quesada. And that's a case before this Supreme Court, 985 Southwest 2nd, 757. In that case, Quesada was a bankruptcy debtor, had a judgment, monetary judgment entered against her. Owsley, here I'll quote from the case at page 758. Owsley claims the record indicates Quesada waived all protection of the automatic stay, but she had no authority to do so. That's what this court held. It cited a string of cases in that regard. Interestingly, in that string cite is a case in Re Cobb, C-O-B-B, which is a case that's been cited by the respondents in this case. It was also cited in a bankruptcy, Western District bankruptcy case, the Hoskins case that was also cited by the respondents. What the court will find when it looks at this waiver issue is that Hoskins and Cobb are completely different from the facts in this case. In Hoskins and Cobb, a bankruptcy debtor asserted a violation of the stay, then went before the bankruptcy court, this is Hoskins, and ignored its own motion arguing a violation of the stay and argued another motion on the merits and disregarded the fact that they had raised the bankruptcy stay. That's not the facts of our case. At no time did Ms. Porter or her counsel go before the circuit court, raise the bankruptcy stay issue, and then later disregard it. Those cases, Cobb and Hoskins, are inapposite to the facts before us. Also, this idea that you can have a retroactive validation of a stay. And that's what the respondents want, how they want to couch what just happened in the bankruptcy court. I submit that in order to have a retroactive validation of the stay, you have to move for it. You have to file a motion asking the court to retroactively validate the violation of the stay. The respondents never did that. They never did it in the bankruptcy court. They've never done it in this court. There is no motion to that effect anywhere. And the appellant in this case has never had the opportunity to argue against such a retroactive validation.
Of course, we have this most recent order by the bankruptcy court saying we can hear this case.
Excuse me?
We have the most recent order from the bankruptcy court saying we can hear the case in the Supreme Court.
It's from the new case.
That's a different bankruptcy action.
That's the newer bankruptcy
But you're saying the district court or the bankruptcy court acted sort of as a volunteer in reaching this issue, and it's because that wasn't briefed or argued.
I think, Your Honor, you have couched the language, this disputed language, most appropriately by stating that the only thing it had to do was the bankruptcy court identifying the fact that the respondents were not going to proceed against her personally, and at that point, the bankruptcy court felt satisfied that there was no need to reopen that case.
Are there any further questions? not the cases that